Last year, Walmart sold $285.2 billion worth of shoes and soap, gadgets and groceries, often at prices 15% lower than its competitions. It's not only the world's biggest retailer, it's the world's most powerful company, employing 1.6 million people across the United States and throughout the world. I'm Julie Burstein here for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. And I'm here with the author of The Walmart Effect. It's a new book about the good, the bad, and the ugly aspects of Walmart's way of doing business, published by the Penguin Press. And I'm pleased that it brings Charles Fishman to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So can you, in a nutshell, define what you describe as the Walmart Effect?
The Walmart Effect is all the ways that Walmart has an impact on our daily life and on the economy and business of the country and the world. Walmart obviously has an impact on what things cost. It has an impact on what things cost even if you never shop at Walmart. Walmart has an impact on the quality of merchandise that's produced, what range of merchandise is produced, where that merchandise is produced, and what the people who make it and sell it make as a result of producing it and selling it through Walmart. And that's not to touch the impact that Walmart has on wages in retail, on the shape of communities. So as I try and argue in the book, I think Walmart touches the life of every American every day in some way, and that's really a remarkable impact for a single company.
Well, I found it fascinating. You know, I know about Walmart, but I have to say I've never shopped in one. Perhaps it's because of the places that I've lived. You say that everyone lives within 15 minutes of a Walmart, or most Americans, but maybe in this New York area, we're the only ones who may not.
Right here in New York City, we're in a little bit of a Walmart-free zone. It is certainly one of the biggest, I think it's without question the biggest community in America without a Walmart. But they're right across the river. They're right across the Hudson in New Jersey.
You start out the book with some interviews with people who worked with Walmart, but Walmart is so incredibly secretive. Was it difficult to find people who would talk to you about their experiences?
Well, it's interesting. In order to find people who had helped create Walmart, Walmart is everybody who has spent any time in the stores has an impression of what it's like to work for Walmart at the retail level as a clerk or somebody doing the checkout line at a store. But we really have no image at all of what working at headquarters is like, working in the home office. If you think about the phrase, the IBM man, or what it might have been to work at Amazon or eBay in the go-go days, we sort of at least have some image of what those places were like, whether that's accurate or not. Walmart isn't just the largest store in America and the largest store in the world. Walmart's the largest company in the history of human civilization. And yet we have no idea what the headquarters operation is like. So I was very curious about that, and I asked Walmart many times to participate in the reporting of the book, and they always declined.
Would they let you go and visit the headquarters, or did you have to learn
about it? I visited the periphery, but never inside. But I decided that I wanted to talk to people who'd helped create the company, and I advertised in the newspapers around in Bentonville and around Bentonville for people who had helped create the company to get in touch with me. I provided an email address in the ad and tell me their stories if they wanted to. And about two dozen people replied to those ads. And I talked to all those people who were willing to talk. And of those people, they all had friends and colleagues who still lived in the area and pointed me in a bunch of really productive directions. So in the end, I was able to talk to a lot of people who had really devoted their lives to helping create Walmart. And those people are just, you know, hardworking, salt of the earth Arkansans, Arkansas residents. And what a fascinating tale they have to tell, you know.
I was fascinated by hearing about people, a couple of men who had joined in the 1970s who knew Sam Walton. Can you tell a little bit about what his philosophy was and how it affected those early managers who worked directly for him?
Well, Sam Walton was an incredibly focused, hardworking, and demanding boss. And Sam Walton had, I think, a single insight about the American character, which proved to be vitally important. He figured out that we would change our behavior to pay just a little less for the things we bought anyway. That if we knew consistently we could get toothpaste or soap or diapers or underwear somewhere 50 cents or a dollar a package cheaper, we'd go to that place. That's the entire secret behind Walmart. And he really believed in holding managers tremendously accountable for their performance. And so he actually created a whole generation of merchants with the people who came to work for him in Arkansas in the 60s and 70s who believed in selling stuff cheap and moving as much volume as they possibly could.
You write about the way they talked about those early years, which I can imagine continue, the hours that the managers are expected to put in, where most arrive before 7 in the morning and often stay till 6 or 7 at night, and that working on a Saturday was not just optional, it was required.
Right. I mean, I think one of the most striking things, even today, is the work culture at Walmart inside headquarters. The white-collar staff at Walmart typically gets to work between 6 and 6:30 in the morning, and most of them don't go home at 6:30 at night, but even if they do, they've put in a 12-hour day. That's five 12-hour days, 60 hours, and it is required to work half a day on Saturday. There's a big Saturday meeting that's very important where all the senior managers who work at headquarters come together every Saturday. You now, in a sort of a concession, you get one Saturday a month off. But most Walmarters work a minimum of 65 hours a week. And even if their competitors at Target and Kohl's and Kmart and Sears are getting to work at 7 or 7:30, the Walmarters have already been at work for an hour. And so that's an amazing competitive advantage.
What engenders that kind of dedication? I mean, that's a lot of time.
That's a great question. I think especially in the early days at Walmart, there was a real sense of mission because for all the criticism of Walmart now, much of which is appropriate criticism, in the early days when Walmart went into a small community like, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma or Fayetteville, Arkansas, they were bringing a range of products that wasn't actually available at prices that weren't previously available. They were actually improving the lives of those communities. And they were building this business incredibly quickly. And so if you're a business person, if you're a merchant, those are the two things you want to do. You want to grow and you want to provide something that people want. Now that culture has sort of become self-perpetuating. And I think the scale of Walmart, if you're in almost any business, if you're the deodorant buyer, if you're the duct tape buyer, if you're the bicycle buyer for Walmart, you're the person who writes the largest order for deodorant in America. You're the person who writes the largest order for bicycles in America. That's got to be a real professional kick, and they don't have any trouble attracting people.
Charles Fishman is my guest. He's written The Walmart Effect from Penguin Press. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate today. You know, in the book, you move fairly quickly from the men who built Walmart to the innovations that Walmart started, like selling things straight from the pallet in the middle of the store.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most amusing things Walmart does is, for your listeners who aren't that familiar with Walmart stores, most Walmart stores have two or three very wide aisles that are known in Bentonville as Action Alley. And they're much wider than a typical store alley. And right down the middle, a typical store aisle, and right down the middle of the aisle is a standard shipping pallet stacked with stuff. Underwear, deodorant, Halloween candy. I've seen Cisco routers and Remington shotgun shelves piled on the pallets. The stuff sells so quickly, it sort of gives you this impression, the stuff sells so quickly, we aren't even going to bother to put it on the shelves. We forklifted the pallet right onto the floor, take it.
Ripped it open.
Ripped off the shrink wrap, take it. We slapped a price sign on it, take it out of here, and we'll move the pallet and put a fresh pallet in its place. Walmart actually had to be persuaded by the folks at Hanes Underwear, Sarah Lee, to do that. And once they saw how quickly merchandise sold straight off the shipping pallet, It didn't require much persuasion anymore.
One of the most sobering aspects of your book is when you look at those sorts of relationships, like between Haynes and Sara Lee and Walmart, and you said, you know, whoever's buying the deodorant for Walmart is writing the biggest check for the most deodorant in the entire country. Walmart says that they're partners with their suppliers, but you go into pretty specific detail about how that relationship can be very challenging for the manufacturers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to me, the place where the everyday low prices happen is in the relationship between Walmart and the companies that supply it. And Walmart simply has enormous muscle now. One of the stories, this book sort of grew out of a story I did 2 years ago, a magazine story for the magazine I work for, Fast Company. And one of the stories I stumbled on is the story of the gallon jar of Vlasic pickles. Vlasic, which was the number one Vlasic pickle seller in America, had a kind of novelty item, which was a gallon jar of whole dill pickles.
Which, if you think about a gallon jar, what is it, about 18 inches high, and about who needs that many pickles?
Right. It was, as I said, strictly a novelty item.
Yeah.
It was for big events or for mom and pop stores. And the pickle buyer for Walmart thought it might be an interesting product to sell in huge quantities at Walmart. And after a test and a bunch of negotiation, they put it on the floor on pallets for $2.97 a gallon. That's less than a quart of pickles sells for in a grocery store. And not surprisingly, it flew out the door. They were selling just hundreds of pallets of pickles a week across the country.
It also makes you realize Walmart is a place you must drive to, because I can't imagine anyone in New York City who walks home with their groceries bringing home a gallon jar of pickles.
It's definitely what I would call a suburban product, because it weighs about 13 pounds. But the gallon jar of pickles literally destroyed the rest of Vlasic's pickle business. It chewed up their pickle sales in grocery stores because people were literally substituting. They were buying the gallon and using it until the pickles weren't any good anymore. It was such a good deal, and then just go buy another gallon. And in any normal partnership, you would say, you know, the price was such that Walmart was making literally a penny and Vlasic was making a penny on a gallon if they were making anything. The demand for those dills was so high that they had to change their procurement of cucumbers. They had to go deep into Central America to find cucumbers. And they asked permission to raise the price to discourage demand and to make a little money off of it. And Walmart would not let them change the price without pulling all the rest of Vlasic's products off the shelf. It was a very complicated negotiation, but they said, somebody's going to give us this gallon because it's great. And if you don't give it to us, we'll let somebody else give it to us, and then we'll have to take their other products so that they can make a profit. And so Vlasic, over 2 years, saw the profit in its pickle business cut in half. And I think there's a really important lesson in that, which is that people say, you hear often that Walmart's just great at what they do. It's just the triumph of capitalism. It's just the market economy at work. But the Vlasic pickle story is exactly the opposite. There was no flood of cucumbers that required a gallon at $2.97 to get rid of the pickles. There was no softening of demand in pickles nationwide that required lowering the price to move all these pickles. The pickle price, $2.97 a gallon, and I don't have any hesitation saying this, it was a lie. It wasn't a meaningful price. It was a novelty price. And so that wasn't a partnership. That was Walmart holding Vlasic's pickle business hostage. And that also wasn't the triumph of the market economy. It was just one really big company muscling a somewhat smaller company. And Vlasic did a third of its business with Walmart, so it didn't have any choice.
And what happened to Vlasic after that?
Well, Vlasic went bankrupt, and it's important to understand that Vlasic went bankrupt for many, many reasons. It went bankrupt literally within months after Walmart let it raise the price of pickles to $3.47 for a half a gallon. So it really got to double the price. But Walmart knew well the financial health of Vlasic all through this time. And the financial health of Vlasic was not a concern, even though Walmart's chairman, Rob Walton, the son of Sam Walton, talks publicly about the wonderful partnership with suppliers. So I think if you have a partnership, you don't muscle somebody who's ailing anyway.
Charles Fishman is my guest. He has written The Walmart Effect, and he's going to be back in just a moment after a break. The Walmart Effect is from Penguin Press, and Charles Fishman is going to be talking and signing books tonight at 6:30 at Coliseum Books on 42nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. And I'm here with Charles Fishman. He's written The Walmart Effect, which has been published by Penguin Press. Charles, earlier in the show, Barney Frank was here, and one of the things he said about Walmart, which is trying now to get into the banking business, was that he felt that as a corporation, it does not take responsibility for the social impact that it has. And Walmart has been in the news almost constantly lately because of lawsuits, battles over wages and health care, such as the one in Maryland. You've said in your book that all of these concerns stem from Walmart's core mission to always have the lowest price on everything, but that now the company is really looking at it as a public relations issue.
Well, they have a serious public relations problem, which is that the negative consequences of always low price are starting to sort of spin out. Not starting to spin out. People are aware of the most vivid ones. They lock their employees in stores overnight to prevent theft by employees who work overnight. There are lawsuits in 40 of the 50 states. Alleging that Walmart forces people to work off the clock to punch out and finish their work for the day. And two of those have been settled out of court, and two of those have resulted in judgments against Walmart, finding that Walmart, in fact, does do that. What better way to save money than to force people to work for free? The health insurance issue is, of course, a very complicated issue that has to do both with health insurance and with Walmart. But health insurance and healthcare costs are incredibly expensive for all employers in the country, and Walmart is very alert to trying to keep those costs under control. And the result is that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Walmart employees and their children end up getting their health insurance from the government, even though they're employed at Walmart, which the information about that is just coming out, sort of trickling out state by state. And I think people find that astonishing and kind of inappropriate, given the way our health care system is organized. If you have a job, the presumption is that your employer will pay the cost of your health insurance rather than the government.
And so in a sense, we're subsidizing Walmart.
Right. But of course, we subsidize companies all the time. And I think it's important to put Walmart in the context of larger companies. How well would GM, Ford, Toyota, and Honda do if there were no roads in the country? How much do the car makers contribute to the construction of roads? They don't contribute at all. But Walmart is certainly a flashpoint because of the way it treats people. And of course, I almost think it's more interesting to look at the ways in which the products that Walmart sells and insists on selling less and less expensively all the time, how the way those products are made hurts the community in which they're made just because Walmart is insisting on low prices.
Yeah, you end the book with a very poignant look at the Lewis Sprinkler Company.
L.R.
Nelson Sprinkler Company, and what the relentless pressure had done to that company. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found when you visited that community?
Well, L.R. Nelson is one of these great small manufacturing companies that's 100 years old, based in Peoria, Illinois. For those of your listeners who have lawns, almost anybody with a lawn who has a lawn sprinkler has an L.R. Nelson lawn sprinkler. They're caterpillar yellow, and there's tens of millions of them produced.
I do have a couple at home, actually, now that I think about it.
Right. Yeah. So that's their signature color. And Walmart was a huge customer, has been a huge customer of theirs. And at some point in the last year or so, Walmart decided that L.R. Nelson sprinklers were too expensive. Now a reasonable L.R. Nelson lawn sprinkler costs about a hand nozzle, a watering nozzle, costs $7. Walmart's house brand of watering nozzle on the shelf right next to the Nelson one is made in China and costs $2. And so there's if you buy the Walmart house brand, you keep a $5 bill in your wallet. And the Nelson nozzle is husky, it's strong, it feels robust, it feels like it'll last a while. But Walmart said to L.R. Nelson, literally, if you cannot supply us with cheaper lawn sprinklers, then we will stop using you. And the way to supply them more cheaply is to close your U.S. manufacturing and move the manufacturing to China.
Now, why would Walmart need that if they already had a house brand that was $5 cheaper than Nelson? Wouldn't they want to have a variety of you know, I think about that $2 nozzle, which I think I've used them. They last for maybe a couple of months and then they're gone.
Right. They're a one or two season item.
Right.
And I agree with you. But what they want, though, is they want the robust quality at the lowest possible cost.
So they want to keep the quality but have the cost go down.
Right. And they know good and well that L.R. Nelson could shave a dollar or two off the cost of the mid-price or high-priced, quote-unquote high-priced nozzle. You might even ask, even for people on modest incomes, why do we need a nozzle that's cheaper than $7? There are all kinds of big economic reasons, but a hose nozzle is not a vital product for human beings. If you can get one for $7 or for $5.
You can put your thumb over the end of your hose and do a similar
right, that's
thing.
True. But in any case, Walmart literally ordered L.R. Nelson to move its production to China. L.R. Nelson, this past summer, terminated production of consumer products in Peoria. At one point, they had 450 people working in their factory. They do make some lines of complicated industrial lawn sprinkler systems for commercial use. But most of those people have lost their jobs. And I went to Peoria and talked to a group of women who had spent literally decades, many of them, making lawn sprinklers. They finished their careers at L.R. Nelson, making $10 and $11 and $12 an hour. People who said, that's the best job I'll ever have. What was so striking about that is sort of two things. The first is the president of the company actually admitted that Walmart forced it to move its production to China.
Publicly in an interview.
Right, in an interview. Not with me, with the Peoria Journal Star. After that, he wouldn't talk about it anymore. And these women are now stuck in a kind of a downward spiral. Many of them, it almost moves them to tears to talk about it, but many of them shop at Walmart, even though Walmart destroyed their work lives. And so it's really a conundrum. You might ask, why didn't L.R. Nelson simply say no? Well, at the point at which this happened in the Nelson-Walmart relationship, Walmart said, if you can't give us sprinklers at the price we want, we won't buy them from you at all. And the bosses at L.R. Nelson said, we might as well keep a sales staff and a design staff and an executive staff in Peoria, even if we have to lay off all the manufacturing workers, because we're going to lose the business one way or the other. At least 100 people get to keep their jobs. So it really puts a company like that in a box.
You know, when you talk about these things, and as I read the book, I thought, does free market actually apply anymore? It doesn't sound particularly free.
Well, that's right. That's what makes Walmart so complicated, is that it looks like capitalism. But in fact, Walmart stands astride these consumer product markets. Walmart sells 15% of the groceries in the whole country. Walmart sells 30% of all the health and beauty products, 30% of all the toys, 30% of all the bicycles.
And all of those companies have offices in Bentonville to work directly with Walmart.
That's right. That's right. And it's hard to say, I'm going to produce a toy, but I want it to be a success, but I'm not going to sell it through Walmart. And once you start doing business with Walmart, you get the huge sales volume, but then you're subject to doing business on Walmart's terms. I think of Walmart as an ecosystem. Walmart is a kind of terrarium, a kind of world all unto itself inside the American economy. And when you get pulled into the Walmart ecosystem, then you have to play by Walmart's rules. And I think those rules increasingly, Walmart is able to actually defy the normal laws of supply and demand and price because it can impose the conditions it wants to impose.
Charles Fishman is my guest. He's written The Walmart Effect from Penguin Press. In the book, you write about another company that actually said no to Walmart, the Snapper Lawnmower Company. And I'd like you to describe the scene where the new CEO of this lawnmower company actually went to Bentonville to deliver that news.
Jim Weir, the CEO of Snapper, had decided that Walmart's constant price demands to make lawnmowers cheaper and cheaper were literally going to undermine the quality of Snapper lawnmowers, and that was actually what distinguished Snapper lawnmowers was quality. He thought of himself, he thinks of Snapper as the kind of Lexus or BMW or VW of lawnmowers.
I like that image of a
higher end
that has,
right. Higher end. And that's why Walmart wanted that label, that name brand in their stores, was to have a high quality offering. But they kept asking for price reductions. And so eventually Jim Weir concluded that it simply wasn't good business to do business with Walmart. It might be okay this year and next year, but 10 years down the line, it was dangerous. And Snapper had a line of a group of dealers who were selling the lawnmowers. So he goes to Bentonville to deliver the news, and he's ushered into the office of a vice president, the vice president for outdoor products. And the vice president for outdoor products has a desk and a little sitting area for people who come to talk to him. And the sitting area was furnished with actual folding chairs, lawn chairs. The vice president of outdoor products at Walmart is responsible for billions of dollars a year in business. He's got a chaise lounge and a folding chair, a folding lawn chair, in his office that were literally samples left behind by a previous vendor.
And this is where you sit to have your important meeting is on the low fabric webbing.
Right. That's where you sit to do your business with the head of outdoor products. And Jim Weir said it was a very strange and uncomfortable experience. Of course, Walmart would say, think how we saved $800 a chair on each of those chairs times all the vice presidents. Think how much money we didn't spend.
But the companies that made those chairs spent that money
They spent a little bit of
a lawn chair is not $800.
You can buy a chaise lounge at Walmart for $9. So those were not expensive samples. And companies routinely supply samples to their potential vendors. And the interesting thing was that conversation played out exactly as you would imagine. The vice president actually tried to persuade Snapper, the CEO of Snapper, to produce a cheaper line of goods just for Walmart, or to move, you know, all Snapper lawnmowers are made in Georgia. And he asked why Snapper wouldn't simply reduce the cost by moving the jobs overseas. So the things that you hear, you know, or that you might imagine Walmart would do, they did right there. And so Snapper did, in fact, although it was an uncomfortable conversation and an uncomfortable posture, Snapper did pull its products from Walmart, and they gave up 20% of their business in a single day. But Jim Weir thinks that they got almost all that business back very quickly from their independent dealer network, which didn't have to compete with Walmart anymore.
That story and what you said about Jim Weir, which was he was looking not at tomorrow or 6 months from now, but at 10 years from now, seems to be a key piece of this, that if you look at all of these relationships, like the relationship with Vlasic Pickles, it's great right now, but what is this going to lead to down the line?
Right, and that's an extremely challenging thing for business people to deal with, especially publicly traded companies. The decisions about the gallon jar of pickles at Vlasic were made at the CEO level at Vlasic. Do we sacrifice 30% of our business in the blink of an eye just because we're unhappy about selling a gallon to Walmart, and what will that do to our share price and our stockholders and our future ability to deliver goods and so forth? So it is very difficult. The time to think about your relationship with a company the size and scale of Walmart
is before you start it.
Is before you start doing business with them. Most people are so excited to get an order of the scale that Walmart can deliver that they aren't thinking 5 years down the road.
in the book, you look not only at what the Walmart effect is doing to us nationally, but you have a very powerful story about the price of salmon and how Walmart has affected that. And this is salmon that doesn't come from the waters off of Alaska, but this is salmon from Chile.
Right. Walmart buys all of its salmon from Chile. Many New Yorkers may not know that Walmart sells groceries in most of its stores now, huge grocery stores. And Walmart is either the number one or number two seller of salmon in the country. It buys all its salmon from Chile, where, by the way, there were no native salmon at all because Chile's on the Pacific Ocean, not the Atlantic Ocean. And so the salmon is produced in salmon farms that are not well regulated and processed in processing facilities that are not well regulated. And so huge quantities of ocean pollution are created, and people work in essentially sweatshop conditions, very, very, very hygienic sweatshop conditions to produce the salmon. Walmart sells salmon for $4.84 a pound nationally, any store you go in that sells groceries. And I think of that as a price that really is too good to be true. It's so low that you sort of think, wow, how are they doing that? And it's too good to be true in the sense that it's not too good to be true for the person buying the salmon, but it's too good to be true for someone somewhere. And I think prices like that need to draw our attention. It's priced so low because the cost of treating people humanely and safely and the cost of aquaculturing those salmon in a way that is sustainable in terms of pollution and the environment aren't in the $4.84 a pound.
By the end of the book, I was exhausted and also worried. What do you see the Walmart effect to be over the next 10 years? And do you see any check on these sorts of things that are happening?
Well, I think the conversation about Walmart is stuck in this country between people who shout, Walmart is good. If you're of modest means, Walmart is your best friend, and that is actually true. And people who shout back, Walmart is terrible. Look at how they treat employees. Look what they're doing to communities. Look at all those parking lots, not to mention what they do to forests and oceans and factory workers in other countries. And my goal is to try and get people to push beyond that and to say Walmart has incredibly beneficial impact. The entire economy of the country is much more efficient because of Walmart in ways that are positive, in ways that are the equivalent of turning out the light in an empty room, pure savings. And Walmart does all kinds of damage, and it's okay to acknowledge the good and manage the damage. We're very accustomed to doing that. The car is one of the greatest things about America and one of the worst things about America. That's why we have airbags and seat belts and zoning laws and catalytic converters. We love our cars. We don't like everything they do to us. And I would argue that it's time to move the conversation to a point where we say Walmart is a completely new kind of economic power that we've never seen before, literally a company with the power of a nation. And we need to understand it better and manage it better.
Well, Charles Fishman, thank you very much for joining me today on the Leonard Lopez Show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Fishman is the author of The Walmart Effect from the Penguin Press.